Welcome to the podcast service of Sydney's Heart 1032, available on the web at heart1032.com.au.
Okay, well, I need to make a few comments before our next interview. Our policy here at Open House is that we focus on the Christian message, on God, His Son Jesus, and the life that He calls us to. We do not engage in debate about specific churches or denominations, and we certainly don't take it on ourselves to declare one church right or wrong. Well, this next interview is going to be quite confronting for those of us who call ourselves Christians. Margaret Simons is a journalist, and she spent 2 years investigating some of Australia's larger Pentecostal churches. She's not a Christian. She'll describe herself as a seeker. And I recorded this conversation with her during the week, and what resulted was a fascinating description of how a non-believer views the church, what aspects were attractive, and what turned at least this person off. Now, Margaret mentions specific churches and denominations. She mentions the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, and two very well-known, high-profile Pentecostal churches. So we had a dilemma. Do we edit out Margaret's words or let her speak uncensored? And we've chosen the latter because of the breadth of Margaret's statements. There is something here that all Christians can learn from. However, Margaret Simon's words are certainly her own and not the position of Open House. Margaret, welcome to Open House.
Thank you very much.
We could almost call you a church secret shopper, couldn't we?
You could, perhaps. More of a window shopper, perhaps, than getting inside the store, but yes.
Yeah? Oh, well, you got inside the services, at least.
I did, yes.
Yeah. What initially got you interested in visiting these churches?
Well, I think the rise of a new sort of enthusiasm in religion, I suppose, is of interest to a lot of people, not only the people who are part of the congregation. You often hear a lot of concern about whether it has political implications. Some people, of course, would like it to have political implications. Others are worried about that. And so I was commissioned by the publisher, really, to look at the whole area and to try and assess what the politics of this were. But it was a topic that interested me a great deal as well, I have to say.
In the book, you describe yourself as a self-confessed agnostic. Now, I'm very, very interested to know what your very first church experience was like. When you walked in that Sunday, was it kind of totally foreign to you?
Well, I don't know that I use that word agnostic, do I? I was raised as an atheist. I don't call myself an atheist anymore, nor do I call myself a Christian. I suppose the shorthand way of saying what I am is a seeker. I wouldn't describe myself as somebody with no religious beliefs, but I don't have any allegiance to any particular religion at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, what was your first experience like in the church service?
Well, one of the main things that you notice going into a Pentecostal church, I suppose, particularly something like the Paradise Church in Adelaide or Hillsong, is the lack of the conventional religious iconography. You don't see crucifixes, you don't see the Stations of the Cross, you don't see any of the usual things that you would in a more traditional sort of church, I suppose. The second thing that strikes you is the obvious enthusiasm of the crowds. And the music. I think the music is obviously very important, certainly been important in the history of a church like Hillsong, for example. And then the sermon, very rarely a pulpit, of course, in these sorts of churches, often seems a little bit like a pep talk or almost a life coaching session, as much about life skills and attitude to life as it is about relationship with God sometimes, although I guess the churchgoers themselves would say that there's no gap between those two. Mm-hmm. So it's very different, I think, from the sort of church services I went to as a child when I was a brownie, which were fairly conventional Anglican services. Fairly dull, really, and that's one thing you wouldn't say at Pentecostal services. They're not dull.
No. Were you welcomed by the local congregation?
Yes, I was. There was certainly no hostility. There was some pressure to become more involved than I wanted to. As
in
a newcomer, I was often invited to go after the service into a special room to talk about issues of faith and my relationship with God and so on. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to remain as an observer rather than a participant. Sometimes there were varying levels of pressure to do that, varying levels of pressure to donate money as well.
To you personally,
but, yes,
or just
I certainly couldn't say I was made to feel uncomfortable or unwelcome at any stage.
Yeah, but were you feeling the pressure personally, or just as sitting as a member of the congregation? And these can be very, very large congregations as well.
Yes. No, not personally. Yeah. But as anybody who's attended these services will know, there comes a point when buckets are handed round, credit card slips are often available either on the chairs or under them. The buckets themselves often have holes in the bottom, so coins aren't what's required. It's paper money or credit card slips or checks. So that, you know, there certainly is a lot of money. I mean, people say, I've heard it said, in fact, from the stages in these churches, that people put too much emphasis on the money. But, I mean, the money is very obvious. It's very obviously part of the services and part of the church themselves. They're not poor institutions.
We're talking to Margaret Simons. She's kind of been a bit of a church secret shopper in many ways. She would describe herself as a seeker. She's a journalist, and she's written up her experiences into a little book. And this is Open House. We'll podcast this via the openhouse.net.au blog site as well. Now, the whole issue of finances, obviously that's one of the big write-ups that you talk about in your book.
Yeah.
You've got to raise the question, though, why churches do need money to survive. They need money to do their ministries and their services.
Certainly.
And why maybe should the larger churches be singled out in comparison to a whole denomination? I mean, there's a number of denominations in Australia, and all of them have got buildings, and all of them have got modes of taking up offerings and things like that.
Well, the key issue, I suppose, is accountability. If you look at some of the more conventional churches, there are usually accounts, there are usually boards with a diffusion, if you like, of power and responsibility and methods of accountability within the structure, just like any incorporated association or other community group. One of the issues which I think is of concern with churches like Hillsong, which are made particularly the subject of my study, is that the levels of accountability are really very low. Now, having said that, what I also say in the book is that I found no evidence of dishonesty or of money going astray. There certainly is a lot of money flowing through the business, and there are also very low levels of accountability. Now, sadly, human history tells us that where you have a lot of money and low levels of accountability, you leave yourself vulnerable and open to problems. I have no evidence that there are problems there at the moment, but certainly, if I was a Hillsong churchgoer, I think I would be concerned about that.
Did you raise this with any of the leadership of Hillsong?
Well, I approached Hillsong for an interview. Now, I was never actually refused an interview, but I had an exchange of emails trying to set up times and places and so on. It never seemed to come off. It was never convenient at various times. Eventually, after many attempts, I gave up.
Have you had any response afterwards, though?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, maybe it hasn't been out long enough. Obviously, we want to give Hillsong the benefit of the doubt to some degree. Like you said, you still didn't find anything wrong.
No, I found no evidence of dishonesty. There are some issues there, but for example, the pastors there often get quite handsome speaking fees and so on from other churches, and when they go on tour, books and tapes and so on that are sold, the royalties go to the pastors. Now, in other sorts of churches, one might well regard those sorts of things as just part of the job and not expect the pastor to get extra money. But there's no secret about that. The congregation are well aware of what's happening there. Nobody's tried to hide it or cover it up. So presumably the congregation are happy with it. So it's a little unusual, but I certainly wouldn't describe it as dishonesty.
But for you as a seeker, that was a little bit off-putting?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, you've talked about the music and how you were welcomed at these churches, and you've talked about some of the investigations you've done into the financial side of things. What about the actual message from the church? You've visited these churches over a period of 2 years.
Yes.
If you were to bring the messages down, could you recite them back to me as to what you kind of felt you learnt over that time?
Well, the overwhelming message is that one's personal relationship with God is of overriding importance. I didn't find that there was a huge message to do with social activism or with politics, and one of the conclusions in the book is that the sort of conspiracy theories you hear sometimes, if you like, about the political agenda of these churches, I don't think those are substantiated. Having said that, the constant message seems to be that a relationship with God is the solution to the world's problems. And so, if anything, it's a message that's against political activism of other kinds. Now, whether or not you think that's a good thing probably depends on your personal belief.
Well, it's interesting, especially after the recent election, the great fanfare that's been made about the rise of the political right. Well, obviously, something didn't work there.
Well, exactly, and that's one of the things I say in the book. I don't think the religious agenda really had much role at all in the recent election, and I, for one, wasn't surprised as a result of the research I did for the book. But, of course, others were expecting that to be a huge issue.
Yeah. Margaret, as you sat in these churches, was there ever a time when the sermon really spoke to you? To you personally?
Not really. Those times that I was moved, it was watching the congregation, and I did a lot of interviews, which are some of which are reported in the book, with individual members of the congregation, and some of those moved me. The sermons themselves, not really, no. I can't say that I was really moved by them.
Mm. Can you say why?
Well, quite often I would sort of be going along and thinking, yes, I can see that, I agree with that, that's a good message or something of that sort, and then something else would be said that would simply jar with me. I remember one in particular, this isn't actually something that I was present at, it was on a DVD that I got from the Paradise Church in Adelaide. I can't even remember the name of the pastor, I'm afraid, but it was a visiting pastor, and he was talking about how God's blessing continues through generations, and he talked about how Jewish people, descendants of Jewish people, have been blessed by God. And then he talked about how if you go through fortune, you find that New York's richest people and so on were often Jewish. And I thought, well, it's hard to fit the Holocaust into that message somehow if the Jewish people are so blessed.
Right.
So quite often I would be, you know, going along quite happily and feeling that the message was a valuable one, and then there would be a jarring note. I have to say I found the whole prosperity gospel thing a difficult thing to come to terms with.
Okay, so as a seeker you found that difficult to hear. What most turned you off about that?
Well, it's a bit convenient, isn't it? It's a bit convenient to say it's all right to seek money for yourself, because if you're rich, it's a sign of God's blessing. The slightly less comfortable aspect of that is the implication that somebody who is less well-off or less prosperous is not blessed, and that there must be a good reason for that. Now, I find that a bit objectionable, really. Mm. I remember in my few days as a brownie attending church services as a child, we used to sing a hymn about how God had decided, I think it's in another verse of All Things Bright and Beautiful, God had decided that some people are rich and some people are poor, and that's just fine and that's how it is. Well, that's not a message I'm comfortable with, and it's not the conventional Christian message, I don't think, either.
No, and I'm certainly with you when it comes to the prosperity gospel. I'm right against it. At the same time, those who really promulgate that will say it's actually not all about you just receiving it for yourself. You are blessed to then pass on the blessing to other people.
Well, that's right. Brian Houston, in fact, has written in one of his books that one is blessed to be a blessing. Well, you know, I'd like to see that, and I think one of the ways in which Hillsong could perhaps convince us of that is to be a lot more transparent about how some of the money is actually spent on community works and charity works and so on. It's, in fact, very difficult to find that out.
And yet, at the same time, you have got the well-known gifts to, say, World Vision for the Tsunami Appeal, and there's a number of fairly public offerings that are often taken at the conferences for overseas charity work and for orphanages and things like that?
Well, that's fine. Open the books. Let us see.
Let us see
what proportion of the money that's coming in goes in those ways and how it's accounted for, just like any other community group would.
This is Open House. We're talking to Margaret Simons. She's a journalist and she went visiting churches for a couple of years as a seeker to see what she would find. Margaret, again, I want to kind of spiral back to the message as to what you received, because I'm really interested to know how much you heard about Jesus as you visited churches over those 2 years. Did you find you were able to hear enough about his life, his message, what he's all about during that time?
Well, certain parts of his life and message. Wasn't much about camels and eyes of needles, since we're talking about prosperity gospel. I got certainly a huge emphasis on trying to relate the stories of the gospel to everyday life now, and some of that was quite powerful. Certainly some of the pastors are good storytellers and good presenters, often a very sort of anecdotal, sort of folksy almost way of trying to talk about relationship with God and the gospels. Jesus emerging as a personality, not so much, I would say, in my experience. I mean, there were exceptions to that. It's hard to generalise over 2 years of services, but certainly I didn't really get the impression of a living person a lot of the time, or else the personality varied depending on who the pastor was and what message they wanted to push that week.
Was it more a case of you were hearing, like you said, like a life coaching kind of message rather than a message about Jesus himself?
Well, yes, a lot of it was sort of almost like motivational speaking. And you can get that at management courses these days. You don't have to go to church. I'm not saying it's bad, by the way, not at all. I suppose to a certain extent it's hard not to be a little bit sceptical of that sort of thing. It's very common these days.
Mm. And if I was to throw this question to you, how do you become a Christian, based on what you've heard over the last 2 years, how would you answer that?
Well, I suppose you have to accept the Christian idea of God, which, of course, has a great deal in common with other ideas of God. So then the question for somebody like myself would be, well, is there something in particular about the Christian notion of God which has a particular truth or message, which varies from other religions?
Mm-hmm.
While I would say that I do think there is probably a God, I have yet to be convinced that it's a Christian God.
Right. Yeah. Mm. So I'm just wondering, those of us in evangelical churches, whether they be charismatic or conservative or whatever, we do place a lot of emphasis on, you know, trying to communicate the essentials of what it means to become a Christian, to become a follower of Jesus. And I'm just wondering, you know, over those 2 years, whether you were able to hear that and whether, you know, to the point where you can actually recite it back to me.
No, not really. I mean, there's a whole load of contradictory messages in there. You will hear about how it's important to appear well, you know, to look as though you're a thriving sort of person. There's lots of messages about being attractive for your husband, for example. Messages certainly about prosperity in every sense, not only the financial.
Yeah.
There are messages about reaching out to others, but usually that's about reaching out to others in order to bring them to church, in order to bring them to a relationship with Christ.
Yeah.
And that is seen as the whole of the answer to the world's problems. Now, I can totally understand how, from an evangelical Christian point of view, that makes sense, but it's not a message that speaks to me necessarily.
Yeah. And the whole issue of personal sin and what we call repentance, or turning away from that and trusting Jesus to forgive our sins, did you hear that message?
Yes, I heard it. One of the messages that one does hear at these services.
Yeah, okay. Mm. So you did hear that. Obviously, it didn't connect with you at all.
No, not really. I suppose, you know, and I'm not suggesting this is the fault of the pastors or anything, but at an intellectual level, I didn't find the message all that convincing.
Right.
You know, there were too many inconsistencies, too many jarring notes. I mean, that little example I gave about how Jewish people are supposedly blessed because of Abraham, you know, what about the Holocaust? How do you square that? Where was God? There doesn't seem to be any room to argue or to question or to engage on that intellectual level. And certainly for somebody such as myself, I need that.
Yes.
I'm not saying it's all there is.
Yeah.
There obviously is the spiritual and the emotional dimension as well. But what I found lacking was that intellectual dimension.
Yes. And Margaret, will you continue to search? Because there, when it comes to the intellectual side of things, there is a raft of books and courses and churches. There's a number of churches, even, you know, in your own city, that will take a more intellectual approach to the Christian faith. Is this a finished thing for you?
No, I don't think it's ever finished, is it, as long as one's alive?
That's good
no,
to hear.
It's not a finished thing for me at all, but I suspect that the Pentecostal churches are not for me.
So, I mean, reading some work by, obviously, C.S. Lewis would be wonderful, and Oz Guinness,
well,
and some
I've read
of those
Lewis, kinds. And I also have a number of Jesuit friends. I find their thinking very appealing, but I find the attitude of the Catholic Church towards women, historically and to some extent in the present day, very challenging. If I'd been brought up a Catholic, maybe I'd find a way of reconciling that, but I'm afraid they're not going to convert me with it.
Right, okay, so there's still some barriers elsewhere as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Of course, you know, putting on my Sheridan Voysey, the impromptu evangelist hat, I'd be saying it's still the person of Jesus that really matters most.
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know what your background was, whether you were brought up within a church.
No, I wasn't.
Certainly, I have many friends who are Christians, who do have an allegiance to a particular church, and they find ways of reconciling these things, and they focus on what's central to them and important to them in their faith, and I'm certainly not criticising them for that.
Mm.
But I'm coming from outside, and sometimes it's harder to decide that those things don't matter when they do seem to be a fairly central part of the image and the message and the personality of the church.
Yeah, well, I do pray for your continued journey, because I think there are some answers out there, but I think it's been fascinating to talk to you, because you've given us a real window as to what it's been like for somebody like yourself, who's a thinker and who's a journalist who's looking for facts. You're not just persuaded by an emotional appeal. You really want to know that there's some sort of substance here, and what it's been like to visit a few churches. And I think that's been very, very valuable. Just one last thing. You mentioned at the end of your book that one of your journalism students was going through some tough times with an abusive boyfriend, I think it was.
Yeah.
And you found yourself almost suggesting that she went to church.
Yes, I did.
What was going on there?
Well, she was a very talented young woman. And I should explain, I was in the role of a teacher to her. I'd been given the task of training her in some journalism skills. She was a very talented young woman. She really stood out for her intelligence and her liveliness and so on. But yes, she was very troubled. The immediate problem was an abusive boyfriend, but there were deeper problems than that. And as I got to know her, I realised that her troubles went well back. Well, by the time I met her, I had already met a number of people within the Pentecostal churches who had been very troubled, very really? Like her. People had suffered from drug problems and anorexia and all sorts of issues of that sort, and who had found salvation within the church and in a relationship with God. I found myself tempted to suggest to this young woman that she go to church, but felt that I couldn't do it because, of course, I didn't believe myself. And I didn't want to be a hypocrite. And I wrestled with that for some time. What I did do in the end was the more conventional thing of putting her in touch with her employer's counselling service, which they offered to employees, making sure she got to the first appointment, organised various networks of support and so on around her. I didn't take her to church. Now, I've lost touch with this young woman now. I don't know how the story ended up, but when I last heard, things were not going well. She eventually lost her job, and so I still don't know what would have happened if I'd taken her to church. She may well have rejected it entirely. She wasn't a Christian, or maybe she would have been saved.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I guess the thing is that, again, you have seen lives changed.
I have seen lives changed, that's right, and I respect that.
Mm. Well, Margaret, may you continue your journey and look forward to meeting you somewhere down the road.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, bye.
It's journalist Margaret Simons there, who's written a book on her experiences of as a journalist and as a seeker going to various churches. Yes, the big ones, but also some other small ones as well. And it's been quite interesting reading.
We hope you enjoyed this Heart 103.2 podcast. To listen to more great audio, visit heart1032.com.au.